Tell the people what you're here for.
Bring everything out closer to the people.
We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Trouble.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
Much confidence in collective action, they begin to see it as, well, I'll improve my living standards by working longer hours, going into debt, supporting a tax cut, my pension's not going to be there, maybe I'll go into the stock market. And what you end up with is, we're not fighting anything collectively anymore. We're not fighting on the street, we're not fighting politically, and we're getting into neoliberalism. So there has to be a break with past practice and all of these things. I think if there was that kind of explosion from below, you'd find a lot of questions being asked about how we do things, and maybe we could revive the labor movement.
That was Sam Gindin, a former CAW member and current professor at York University. Sam joins us tonight on Radio Basics for part two of our discussion on unions and the fate of Ontario working class in recessionary times. But first,
Justice says we can't have any more Caledonians. And unless average residents or average people step forward and fight this battle, the politicians will not touch it.
That was Doug Fleming, leader of the new anti-native militia being formed by non-native citizens of Caledonia to effect a citizen's arrest against so-called native lawlessness in the area. We will speak with Tom Kiefer, one of the main organizers of tomorrow's opposition to the anti-native militia, later. All this and more on CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics.
It's more than a financial profit. United Snakes won't stop it. Blow for blow, the flow of the commentary gets heavy. Heavy. 6 septillion tons to spinning steady. Stepping into a new phase.
New phase.
New force representing our slavery days.
The seeds of wheat to crop is much more than you figure. Yo, if he's a black man, be a nigga.
I have been a fucking maker, can him.
Against how we end up.
A sucker selling out. For the sake of a screaming shout.
Elements don't roll with nonsense. Rather kick a little bit of science.
Science about controlling actions of another. America was built on the sweat of black sisters and brothers.
Never allowed to read, but allowed to bleed and breathe.
Stripped of our creed. Creed and religion surviving on intuition.
And what the master said, give up.
Besides, the black man is the original lord of the land. So I'm clenching my right hand. Brothers and sisters, we must fight this. Slumlord, overlord, of the concrete jungle.
But I'm humble as I witness my knuckles are crumble. Like the shack that I live in, the house that I rent from him.
Roach infested, I'm sure that the rats are nested. And he doesn't work, he still hasn't checked it. Disrespected me for the last time. I'm loading up my nines, time to step in double time. Bullseye,
another point scored. Right between the eyes of my landlord.
They tell me to hold my peace, but I just can't. But I'm defrost of the rap group of Point Blank. So now I'm chilling at the table with my family, hypothetically. Trying hard to keep my mind off the economy, yeah. I know the rules and my fight, I want to pass the test.
You're listening to Radio Basics, CHRY 105.5 FM.
the situation in Caledonia, where members of the Six Nations have been reclaiming their illegally occupied land since February of 2006, is escalating. The indigenous men, women, and children at the reclamation site, who have resisted numerous attacks and threats from the OPP and various vigilante groups, now face the possibility of a hostile militia being formed by the anti-native residents of Caledonia, along with some outside agitators. This militia would patrol areas in Caledonia by car and by foot, wearing uniforms and communicating with radio equipment. If they see a native person doing something they deem illegal or you know, just don't like, they would be empowered to physically assault a person or, in their own words, effect a citizen's arrest. In other words, hold that native person until such time as the OPP could arrive and take this so-called prisoner to jail. In other words, there would be an organized goon squad operating in Caledonia with the ability and justification to attack native people peacefully demonstrating on their legal territory. A meeting for the formation of this militia has been called for tomorrow at 7 p.m. And in response to this disturbing development, non-native solidarity activists from throughout southern Ontario will also be heading down to Caledonia in order to show their opposition to the racist proposal. Transportation to the protest for anyone wanting to go down is being organized, with buses leaving from Toronto at 4:30 p.m. and should return by 10 p.m. that night at the latest. People should contact 3903fnswg@gmail.com to reserve a spot on the bus and get details on the demonstration tomorrow. Here to discuss the show of opposition to the Caledonia militia is Tom Kiefer. Tom is one of the main organizers for tomorrow's demonstration and has been a longtime solidarity activist with the Six Nations of the Grand River. Thanks so much, Tom, for being on today.
No, thank you.
Definitely. So to begin, can you give us a little bit of a background into the kind of anti-native, the racist organizing that has been going on in Caledonia since the reclamation began in February of 2006?
Sure. I mean, it's a complicated subject, and it's taken many different forms. But I guess you could say the beginning of the anti-native organizing happened with the town's business leaders. Mostly, you know, people in the Chamber of Commerce, realtors, bankers, those kinds of people stepping up to organize protests against Six Nations. And they were obviously wanting to defend their interest in developing native land and therefore wanted to stop that protest from happening. And since then, those people who were actually mostly tied in with the Liberal Party and close friends with Dalton McGuinty and his party were then supplanted by other more ideologically hardline anti-native activists, because Dalton McGuinty threw a bunch of money at the town of Caledonia, and that sort of assuaged some of the organizing that was done by these business leaders. And now Gary McHale, who used to live in Richmond Hill, north of Toronto, has decided to move to the area. He lives in a little town of Binbrook. And other organizers, like this man, Mark Vandermass from London, have also come to the area. And they've essentially been organizing since the fall of 2006, various protests directed against Native people. They are claiming that non-Natives are being discriminated against, that there is a two-tier system of justice that is oppressing white people and allowing Native people to commit crimes. They are arguing that Native people at Six Nations are the equivalent of terrorists for standing up peacefully for their land. Hmm. And they've also fabricated a whole number of instances where they accuse Native people of firing weapons in the direction of people of Caledonia, and just essentially done everything they can to fan the flames of discontent in that area.
And does this at all, these anti-Native activists, do they at all represent the majority of residents, the non-Native residents of Caledonia?
I think that, it's a complicated situation, because there's a lot of different divisions in the town. There's, like I said, there's class divisions with people at one end that, really want to develop Native land, because that's how, the tax base of that municipality is going to grow. It's not sustainable unless there's more and more subdivisions and the tax money that comes in goes into, maintaining and building there in terms of property taxes. There are people in the town who have lived there for many years and who are, have, friends and relations in Six Nations who are intermarried with people in Six Nations, who are on good terms with people in Six Nations. Then there are also people who have lived there, for a long time as well, but have been, for whatever reason, turned in a racist direction and are, carry long-term racial animosity towards people in the neighboring Six Nations. There's new residents that have just come in the last 5 years and are sort of living in suburbs and, see Caledonia as a kind of bedroom community and commute into Hamilton. And they never even knew that there were Native people, living next door to them. So they've been very surprised by these actions. So I think there is, there is definitely, because Caledonia has been at the epicenter of this struggle, there's been, and there's been no alternative that has been, that has come up, no left-wing alternative that has been able to offer another way forward.
Mm-hmm.
The political, the politics in that town and area has been ceded to the right wing, and they've relied upon a whole series of stereotypes and problematic assumptions to build, to build themselves. Chief among those is that people from Six Nations are citizens of Canada, like everybody. And that's how they claim, they deny Indigenous sovereignty in the first instance, and on that basis are then able to make all of these claims about illegality and of Native people not following the rules of the Canadian state, when Native people in Six Nations have never seen themselves as Canadian, don't follow Canadian institutions, don't vote in Canadian elections, don't pay taxes to Canada, and maintain their traditional forms of governance, which they've had for literally thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. So can you talk about this public meeting that has been announced for tomorrow, and the action that Native Solidarity activists from throughout Southern Ontario are going to mount in opposition to it?
Sure. The sort of impetus to forming the militia, according to the founders of the militia, came from their habit of staging these so-called flag raisings near and sometimes on the Douglas Creek Estate, known by the natives as Ganasado, the protected place, which is the land in dispute, the 300 acres or so that was going to be turned into a subdivision in Caledonia, but which people from Six Nations successfully reclaimed.
Mm-hmm.
Over the last number of years, Gary McHale and his followers have been organizing flag-raising events where they essentially try to get as close as possible to the reclamation site to nail up a Canadian flag or two. And this is a calculated provocation designed to produce a response from Six Nations, and they hope that by keeping the conflict going, the OPP or other repressive parts of the Canadian state can be encouraged to arrest Native people. And at one such of these flag raisings about a week ago, a man by the name of Randy Fleming took a Canadian flag and ran onto Douglas Creek Estate with it. He was then subdued by OPP officers and charged with mischief, I believe. And in a few days later, his brother Doug Fleming announced a call for this militia. And the idea for that was that, he's claiming that Caledonia is a town of complete lawlessness, that the OPP will not intervene in favor of white people in the town, and that essentially the Caledonia residents need to organize themselves and dispense kind of frontier justice, if you will, against Native people that are protesting, or not actually protesting, but, reclaiming, on their own land.
Mm-hmm. And so what about this? I mean, a lot of the mainstream media reporting on this issue, the formation of the militia, if they're not defending its formation or at least, casting it in somewhat of a sympathetic light, the OPP, the state, the police there are being cast as somehow, mediators in the situation between, extremists on both sides. But what is the actual role of the OPP in this situation? Are they simply there trying to keep the order, or are they actually involved in actively, threatening or containing the Native demonstrators or the Native reclaimers?
Well, you have to remember that this this issue came to national and international attention when the OPP on April 20th launched, mm-hmm, an unprovoked raid upon what was at that time a small encampment of Indigenous people at the entrance to Douglas Creek Estate, who had, you know, not gone into the whole territory of, you know, of the 300 acres, but were camped near the entrance and trying to stop.
And almost exclusively women and children at that time, as I understand.
A lot of women and children. And the OPP came in without warning, without notice, despite having said that they would, you know, give notice if they, you know, if they chose to do something. They did this in the wake of the Dudley George inquiry, which is actually still going through the process of recommendations, but, you know, in the wake of a very present provincial discourse around, a national discourse around the OPP's murder of Dudley George. And they came in with, you know, with automatic weapons drawn. They pepper sprayed men, women, and children. They tasered a number of people, and they, as they came in at 4 a.m. and tried to clear the site. So the OPP in the very beginning, you know, they set off this confrontation. They brought it to a new level. And as they were repulsed back, you know, away from the site, and as a security perimeter was set up by Six Nations, which encompassed Highway 6 or Argyle Street, the main artery of Caledonia, and also included blocking the rail lines, the CN rail lines behind the reclamation site, the OPP was essentially put in a position where they had to mediate between non-natives who upset that their town had been, that the main thruway through the town was being barricaded, came out to protest and often uttered you know, racist slurs and shouted racist slurs and, you know, picked fights and threw rocks and bottles and whatnot. And the OPP sort of formed this barrier between the two groups. From that point on, the OPP didn't directly, you know, go after people at Six Nations in terms of the same kind of raid. On the other hand, despite the claims of Gary McHale and others, that the OPP has not acted against Native quote-unquote lawlessness, there have been over 100 criminal charges laid against people from Six Nations in the 3 years since the original reclamation. And the OPP has essentially been gathering information and has been storing charges up to file at a time and place of their choosing. So they've avoided a direct confrontation with Six Nations as a whole, but they've been picking off people, you know, here, there, and everywhere. So there's a large number of people from Six Nations that have non-association charges, that are not allowed to go anywhere near land dispute, you know, disputed areas of land that are being developed. There's actual land claims in Brantford that have gone through a land claim process, or that were in the process of going through this lengthy land claim process, but the city has just said the developers will come in and develop this and start building on it. And there's been, by some estimates, $2 billion of construction projects that have been halted by Six Nations over the last 2.5 years in Brantford. But there's also been injunctions and arrests of people directed against Six Nations people who have been carrying out those protests.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Tom, you know, although, I mean, it could definitely be pointed out that this sentiment of denying indigenous people their sovereignty and their legal right to land is in itself racist and comes from a place of, you know, white nationalism, you know, at the least white supremacism. Gary McHale and these other forces or these other anti-Native leaders have avoided directly engaging in racist dogma, but there is a danger, and definitely neo-Nazis have been present in Caledonia at many of these manifestations before, and you point this out actually in, you know, around the militia being formed or being announced tomorrow, like what the role of neo-Nazis and outright white organized white supremacists will be in its formation.
Yeah, no, that's very true. You know, Gary McHale has tried to position himself as a modern day Martin Luther King, there to defend, you know, and coming into this poor oppressed town where white people, you know, can barely walk the street in fear of what he calls land claim terrorism. And he's mobilized a discourse of equal rights and of charter rights and of equality, all in an attempt to target and disrupt the native assertions of sovereignty. But in the formation of this militia, I mean, he's been doing this for a while, and, you know, we've been active for a long time, you know, a whole number of groups of different activists and organizers in supporting Six Nations. So we haven't wanted to directly confront him in regards to, you know, his small little flag raising efforts to draw, you know, to provoke people, right? Like, that's, we didn't want to play into his game in regards to that. But this forming of a militia is qualitatively different. It is about directing and organizing the capacity to level violence, direct physical violence against indigenous people on their own territory. Mm-hmm. And that means that, you know, if there's, you know, one of the things that Doug Fleming talked about is, you know, this crime wave in Caledonia caused by Native people who then steal things and then run back to the reclamation site where the OPP can't follow them. Well, setting up something like this militia would set up a circumstance whereby, you know, a Native person seen acting suspiciously near the scene of a crime could be jumped upon by this militia, beaten up, you know, accused of resisting their citizens' arrest, you know, and then held until, you know, the OPP comes. And this is the kind of thing that neo-Nazis have been pushing for ever since the conflict first started. Mm. They said, we need to form, you know, a militia, a militant group to go in there and clean out the Natives from the land that they're holding. So this is a very serious threat, and there are neo-Nazis throughout southern Ontario, particularly a group known as the Northern Alliance, but also key figureheads of the far-right movement in Canada, such as Paul Fromm, a noted Holocaust denier and fascist organizer. Mm-hmm. And they've come and they've attended McHale's protests before on numerous occasions, and they're also promoting and discussing amongst themselves the formation of this militia. So we think there's every likelihood that they will, if they're not involved in setting it up, they will be there to partake in it or to encourage the spread of this kind of racist or racist vigilantism elsewhere. And it needs to be opposed. And that's why we're encouraging people to get on the buses just going from Kitchener, from Guelph, from Hamilton, and from Toronto to converge in the town of Cayuga, which is outside of Caledonia, but where this militia is meeting is being held.
Definitely. So what are the details, or will people, you know, contact the email address directly to find out the details of where those buses are leaving from?
Yeah, they can do that. And that's 3903 FN SWG at gmail.com. You can also go to the buses are leaving from the northeast corner of Dufferin Mall parking lot, so at Dufferin and Bloor. Mm. And people can come there. They should you know, the buses are leaving at 4:30 sharp. You can come at 4 o'clock. They'll be making some plaques for the protest there. But it's you know, this is really important. It's one thing to show solidarity for Indigenous people from a distance, or mm-hmm. to partake in Indigenous cultural ceremonies, or to attend powwows, or to, you know, go to public events. Mm. This is about non-Natives taking responsibility to stop other non-Natives from organizing what are essentially, you know, fascist goon squads.
It's reminiscent of the Minutemen, or, you know,
It's been done before, and it also has a historical precedent in regards to how the so-called Indian problem was dealt with, you know, in the Wild West, right? You round up a posse of the white townspeople, and you go out, you know, and you beat up, or you lynch, or you kill Native people. And if they get away with building this militia, it's going to lead to violence, because Six Nations is not going to roll over when confronted by militias.
Definitely. Tom, we listeners hopefully will be out there in full force at Cayuga tomorrow to show, and I think to essentially fill that void and show that there is a non-reactionary and actually a left alternative to, you know, for working class white people, you know, to show their solidarity with Six Nations, rather than to be, you know, have the right wing and essentially fascism fill the political void there.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Definitely.
Okay.
That was Tom Kiefer speaking to us, and he's an organizer of the demonstration that's going to be happening tomorrow, leaving Toronto at 4:30 p.m., and will be heading to Cayuga to demonstrate against the Caledonia militia.
Yep, and right now we're going to go to a song. This is Kanon, and when we come back, we will have Sangin and to finish up part two of our discussion on unionism and the fate of the Ontario working class.
When I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag.
When I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag. And then it goes back, and then it goes back, and then it goes back. Oh.
Born to a throne, stronger than Rome, but violent prone, poor people's zone. It's my home, all I have known, where I got grown, streets we would roam, out of the darkness, I came the farthest, among the hardest survivors, learn from these streets, it can be bleak, accept no defeat, surrender, retreat,
so we struggling,
fighting to eat,
and we wondering,
when we'll be free, so we patiently wait, for that fateful day, it's not far away. But for now we say,
when I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag. And then it goes back, and then it goes back, and then it goes back. Oh.
So many wars, settling scores, bringing us promises, leaving us poor. I heard them say, love is the way, love is the answer. That's what they say, but look how they treat us.
CHRY 105.5, that was Kanon, Waving Flag. Right now, we are turning to part two of our discussion on unionism and the fate of the Ontario working class. As Toronto city workers walk off the job today, many are again pointing the fingers at so-called greedy unions. While the media and government held a cannon to the head of the CAW negotiators, it seems as if the members of QP 79 and 416 are going to face similar scare tactics. To discuss many of the problems facing unions and within the unions themselves, we are joined by Sam Gindin. Sam is a former assistant to the president of the Canadian Auto Workers and currently a professor of political science at York University. He's a frequent contributor to Canadian Dimension, The Bullet, Alternatives, and others. Sam authored a biography on the CAW entitled The Canadian Auto Workers, Birth and Transformation of a Union. Sam joins us live via phone. Sam, welcome to Radio Basics and thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
So, Sam, in regards to the current QP 79 and 416 strike, the issue seems to be that the union will not heed to any concessions. Why is saying no to concessions so important for a union?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things going on. One of them is that workers struggle long to make certain gains, and obviously giving them up at this moment of crisis would be giving up things that are crucial to building the union and to building workers' rights. One of the things that's going on is that a lot of the people who are attacking the unions for being greedy and talking about other people who may not have certain kinds of benefits, their concern isn't equality at all. If it was, they'd be saying things like, if we're in a crisis, why doesn't everybody share in that crisis? Why don't we have a fair tax system that instead of just concentrating on these particular workers?
Mm-hmm, yes. And many people feel that unions should make concessions during the economic downturn.
Part of this is a little bit contradictory in the sense that the government, all governments have been talking about stimulating the economy, and then when it comes to workers, they start talking about taking away their income. So that seems contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
And what it begins to look like is that the interest isn't so much dealing with a concession as using the dealing with the crisis as using the crisis to restructure labor unions and the amount of power that unions do have and have built over the years, and eroding it and weakening it rather than actually being concerned about the crisis. Now, you know, when you're in a time of crisis, one question is whether concessions are the way to go in terms of solving the crisis. Another is that, they, you may have situations where everybody should share, and the question is, what's the best way of actually sharing, solving the problems of the crisis? And in a lot of ways, you would think that one of the things we should be doing, and one of the reasons for why workers shouldn't be giving up things that they want in the past, is that those things should really be spread to everybody, rather than taking them away from the people who have them, and then using that to squeeze everybody else by saying, well, look, you know, organized workers can't even have that, so we have to lower the expectations of everybody.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Is there an alternative to concessions, to making concessions in the face of, you know, tight government budgets?
Yeah, I mean, there's an obvious alternative that, one of the alternatives is that you actually raise revenue through taxation, and you raise the revenue in some fair way, which does mean that you're going to put taxes on the rich especially, but you're going to put taxes on everybody if that's the kind of crisis that exists and that's what you're trying to deal with. But you know, this is not anything that those who are attacking the unions mm-hmm. are raising at all.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I should say that it always depends very much on what the issue is as well. I mean, there are times that this wouldn't be a great time for unions to try to make major wage demands. That would be so difficult in this period and difficult to justify.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a time for workers to say this isn't a time to take away for the long term things that workers have built over a long period of time. And this is actually a period of time in which unions should be talking about universalizing these benefits. This is absolutely crucial, and it's not just a matter of rhetoric. That's one of the problems, I think. It isn't just a matter of workers saying, well, we want everybody to have this. They have to actually show that. And so I think it raises all kinds of questions about how workers handle this, because they have to prove that they are actually fighting alongside and with and for other workers. So, for example, one of the things that happened in the auto industry that left workers so isolated around pensions is that a lot of people didn't have decent pensions. And the issue should have been, well, how do we improve pensions for everybody? And I think it's critical for unions to start thinking in terms of universal social programs, because that makes you less dependent on the corporations to have these benefits. And it builds the kind of solidarity that you can actually protect the benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that leads into my next question. I was going to say that unions seem to be facing a public relations crisis. From the York strike earlier this year mm-hmm. to CAW workers to the current QP strike, it seems they're getting hammered mm-hmm. in the public sentiment, and people generally aren't on their side.
Mm-hmm. This is a really crucial issue, because this has actually been going on for a quarter of a century in terms of this kind of pressure and mm-hmm. pressure on lowering workers' expectations. And what one would have thought, as this crisis unfolded with everybody, you know, with the corporate elite being so discredited through this crisis, in terms of causing the crisis, in terms of what was happening in the financial sector, what was happening with corporate salaries, you would have thought there would have been an opening for a shift to the left, for a shift in terms of strengthening workers, for an attack on the right, for rejection of what's been going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, why didn't that happen? Why did workers fail to do that? And some of it, you know, would have to do with how you handle this in a PR way. But I don't think this is just a problem of communications. It's a problem of real things going on. And I think it raises all kinds of questions about where unions are going in this period and how they're going to come out of this crisis. One of the things that we're seeing is that there is a limit to the kind of gains that workers are going to make in bargaining if they take this on one section of labor at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And it raises the question of, you know, do workers need to develop some broader forms of working class struggle and broader forms of working class organization so they can take these issues on? Now, that means that you start also addressing inequalities within the working class. So you're not isolated. So they can't isolate you because you actually are fighting alongside other workers and trying to win things with them for everybody. And that would be a very important change in the orientation of the labor movement. I don't mean that workers don't often speak to the fact that you know, they want benefits to everybody, but I mean actually thinking through how would we organize so that we really build the working class and aren't just trying to defend ourselves in some small corner. Because the net result of trying to defend yourself in some small corner is that you do get isolated and lose. So this is an absolutely crucial question for workers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you seem to be alluding to some sort of cross-occupational solidarity.
Well, just to give some, some examples, like just the question of bringing other people into unions.
Mm-hmm.
Unions try to do that on their own, and they've been, they've had a little bit of success in some cases, but it's been very difficult to build unions. One of the obvious things to do is to actually cooperate across unions rather than compete to get members. Another thing would be to start servicing workers, whether they're in a bargaining relationship or not, like in the fast food sector.
Mm-hmm.
Let them be members. They can pay a low due structure, and in exchange you do education, you do mobilizing, you provide services. But to think that way requires unions to start thinking about building the working class. So this is a priority if you want to defend yourself and ultimately change society. So it requires a change in what the vision of the labor movement is, what its relationship is to other sections of the working class. And I think it also requires a change in the vision of how you think of the unionized workers, that they're not just workers, that they have lives outside the workplace, they're affected by the environment, by healthcare cuts, by education, and you have to take on all those issues. And then it raises the question of, are unions as they exist today in terms of their structure the best way to do that, or do we actually have to think about other forms of organization, like thinking about should we be organizing unions, or not unions, should we be organizing structures? You can have unions in place, but you can try to complement them with organizing structures that are on a citywide basis, that actually start addressing class issues on a citywide basis, all dimensions of workers' lives, and and lower paid workers who aren't in unions, and the poor, and you try to say, we're going to try to build a citywide organization that's going to do all of this. Now that would be something radical. And the question is, in the last great crisis in the 30s, workers creatively invented new forms of struggle and new forms of organization, like industrial unions, like unions that didn't just represent workers with one skill, but represented workers across a whole industry, independent of their skills, and across a whole number of companies, not just bargaining company by company. So the question today is there anything parallel that might come out of this crisis in terms of a new form of working class organization?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was just thinking when you were saying that, in terms of all the work that isn't counted in our society, say just work to reproduce ourselves at home,
mm-hmm.
Which a lot of times is work that women do,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't get counted, that isn't organized, and
mm-hmm.
Not sort of even counted in history books,
mm-hmm.
might be another method.
No, absolutely. I mean, organizing the working class means organizing all those dimensions of working class
mm-hmm.
life.
Right.
Not just thinking about unions, workers in a particular sector.
Mm-hmm. Sam, maybe if we can just get more general, why is the union movement so crucial to activate social change, or perhaps just to lives of work people in general?
Historically, workers have been able to organize themselves and develop resources. So they've been one section. The unionized section of the working class has represented people who have actually been able to organize themselves, develop structures, develop resources, and also that they've been strategically located, that the system does depend on their work and on their services. So what that's meant is that the working class, on the one hand, has some strategic power in terms of the system depending on it, and it has some organizational capacity that, for example, other sections of society might not have in terms of resisting. So that's one dimension of it. The other dimension is just the nature of what being a worker is under capitalism. And one of the points about capitalism is its relationship to democracy. But the thing about capitalism is that some people sell their labor power because they have to survive to other people who control it. And that's a very fundamentally undemocratic relationship, that somebody is controlling your capacity as a human being and also how your capacity as a human being develops. Now, if we take democracy seriously, then we have to start talking about changing that relationship, that democracy isn't just about a form of government, but democracy is actually about a form of society where people can control their capacities collectively, and that means taking on corporate power. So that's why workers are so central, because at the heart of the relationship of workers to their employers and workers under capitalism is this undemocratic question about people's potentials and who controls them. And that lack of democracy affects everything in society. I mean, if you can't control investment and therefore who has jobs and what kind of jobs and how you relate at work, then you really can't control your life. So I think the working class stands for that issue of democratic control over our capacities and therefore over administering our lives in a democratic way. And, you know, it's because workers are so central to that question, have our position strategically within capitalism in terms of being able to stop production, and have resources because they've actually organized collectively in workplaces rather than be fragmented all over the place, that workers have historically become ended up in the center of this question of changing society. Now, I think what that means is that it doesn't inevitably mean that workers will be radical, obviously, and it doesn't mean that if radical change were to emerge, that it would necessarily start with the unionized working class. It might start someplace else. But I don't think it could be sustained unless you got workers involved in this. I think that's absolutely critical.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. Sam, I know you've put forward ideas in building a more broader movement, but you've also discussed some, you know, concrete alternatives to globalization. You've talked about transforming excess capacity. Mm-hmm. Could you just build on that?
Yeah, let me say something about that, and then I just want to link that back to what we've just been talking about. I mean, one of the questions is, here are the auto workers. The auto industry is in crisis. Society, the whole economy is in crisis globally. And they're being squeezed to give up things that they've won, you know, for over the last 70 years, seven decades, and they're being squeezed. And they're being not just squeezed in terms of giving up, but they're also being, you know, coming out of this is a demoralization about what's possible, an attempt to lower expectations, and to just be satisfied with whatever you can scrape through because you got to survive. So the question is, what could auto workers possibly do about this? You know, what are you going to do, go on strike? Well, that's not helpful when nobody wants your work. And I think that the only way this could have been dealt with is if people stopped thinking about how do we save the companies and started thinking in terms of how do we save the productive capacity in the community. That what's going on is we actually have this productive capacity that the companies don't want, you know, for producing auto parts, for example, but include crucial equipment, tool and die, machinery, molding equipment, that could be used to make almost anything. And the question is, when they close these plants and say, we don't want them, why don't we say we should expropriate them and start thinking about converting them under some kind of a plan? Now, that would necessitate having some plan for conversion and where you're going and what the demands would be. And an obvious one is the environment, because everything, you know, through this next century, everything about how we live, produce, consume, travel is going to be changed, what homes are going to be like, what factories are going to be like, what infrastructure is going to be like. Well, why don't we get ready for that? And I think that, you know, that does a number of things. It means you stop thinking in terms of my loyalty is with my company because it's my job, and you start thinking about a social use and where you fit in socially. It also means you stop thinking about how do I become competitive and lower my costs so I can be competitive, and you start thinking about planning. That's the way we have to think about if we're going to have security. You stop defending the companies for making the cars they're making and start thinking about, well, what else can we be doing socially? You don't just represent the workers who are working, but you start thinking about the the workers who've been laid off, whose numbers are greater than the ones still working. So you start changing all of that. Now, to do this, you know, we don't have the power to do this. It's just an idea. But it means that people can start thinking differently. It means that workers, when a company is running down the equipment, might say, I want to take it over before they run it all down so we can put it under the structure and start converting it. It gives them some initiative that they can take instead of just watching and waiting. And then it raises the question, well, how do you have the political capacity to do this? Because there's no way the Harper government is going to do this, and in fact, the NDP wouldn't do it either. So that means you have to start thinking about, well, how do we deal with this in terms of political capacities? And by political capacities, I mean starting to develop amongst workers a general understanding of what's going on, an understanding of the direction we're going in isn't going to solve our problems. How do you actually make links with others? How do you create new structures through which you can fight back? You take seriously what you're up against. Capitalism is incredibly powerful. And if we want to change things, it's not about listing a whole bunch of good things that we'd like. It's about actually saying, well, how do we do this? And how do we do this collectively? And where does our strength lie? So it requires addressing all those questions. And I think that's what's lacking. And the question is whether through this crisis, people are going to start asking those kinds of questions and taking that kind of perspective, and whether we actually might see something more radical start emerging. And I want to emphasize that when you start talking about this, it's very much of a cultural change,
mm-hmm.
because it means you start talking about things like capitalism and class and, some collectivity, solidarity,
yeah.
democracy in a bigger way. And these are, these are really big cultural changes that don't just happen overnight. But the question is whether through certain kinds of struggle and certain kinds of debates and people starting to take a look at where we're going, we can start changing things in that cultural and political way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another word, too, is planning. And not leaving things up to the coercive laws of competition.
And the point is, and one of the points about those coercive laws is that, if you look at this from the corporate perspective, a lot of companies are going to get hurt by competition. Some will go under. But at the end of the day, the capitalist class restructures. The strongest capitalists, emerge victorious. They take over other ones. And capitalism goes on, and they're stronger. For workers, the competition is always weakening them because workers depend on solidarity. That's what they have. So, finding ways to challenge competition is absolutely fundamental because it undermines your power. And in the end, it never guarantees you anything. Things that you had, 30 years ago when society was poorer, now you're being told are impossible. Things that used to be measures of our success, now you're being told are measures of, our failure. They're now problems. So we have to get at this question of competition. Now, once you start talking about planning things, you have to raise the question, of course, about democratically planning them,
mm-hmm.
Not just some technocratic planning. And then once you start talking about planning your economy, you also have to start talking about international relationships, because you can't plan the domestic economy if you have free trade and the free flow of capital going back and forth. So you also have to start talking not about cutting yourself off internationally, but having a different relationship internationally. That's also planned.
Mm-hmm. Is there any examples that you can think of sort of working alternatives to globalization and free trade along the lines of what you're talking about?
No, you can find small examples of people resisting something or taking on a certain policy, but, this is the dilemma that we're in, and what makes it so difficult right now is that people can't say, well, look at this in this country. They broke out of the system, and this is what happened. We don't have those kinds of examples. You do have examples, in Latin America, mm-hmm. where a number of countries have been looking at forming a regional trade relationship that wouldn't be based on free trade, that might be based on other principles, but they're still very much locked into global capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Although you see some of those examples, the critical thing is that we in the West, in the developed countries, have to start creating a movement that can take those things on and support the people fighting elsewhere. So, it's a difficult thing. What we have to get into our heads is that capitalism is, it's had certain successes historically. It's achieved certain things at great cost, but But one of the questions is, has capitalism reached the point where it's becoming a barrier to human development and the development of human potential? And if it is, we have to be honest about how difficult it will be to change that. You know, a movement here or a movement there or a strike here or a strike there are crucial. They're part of building capacities, but they won't do it. And we have to start having this collective discussion. Okay, well, what would it mean? And then things begin to emerge. And then when something happens in one country, it inspires people in another country. And then they can't just, pitch you against somebody else. They can't just say we're going to move someplace else because workers there are struggling too. So, you know, the struggle is international in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like one avenue for what you're saying is where capitalism has reached a barrier is the environment. I mean, sure, maybe market mechanisms that have worked, but, you know, it seems like we reach a point where we can't wait for the market to solve the problem.
I think that's absolutely right, but you have to be very careful with it because there's a lot of people who are looking to market solutions to solve the environmental crisis, and there's a lot of corporations who are going to, one of the things that might happen is we might have an environmental industrial complex, just like we had a military industrial complex,
right,
where there was a lot of money and subsidies and regulations put in place that support profitability and accumulation in the private sector to solve the environmental crisis. And the outcome of that will be that, A, they won't solve it because it's a bigger problem than just leaving it to markets. That's the whole point about the environment, that it really requires a more holistic solution. And that any solutions they'll come up with will always be, because they're based on markets, incredibly unequal. One of the great inequalities, I think, of the century that we'll see is access to fresh air and fresh water, etc. Who gets access to the, to a clean environment? So that's going to be another issue. But I think what we have to be careful of is not just seeing the environment as a classless issue. I think the environment itself raises questions of power, of class, of justice, of inequality, of capitalism. And that's how we have to frame the environmental issue. So it's an opportunity, but like any issue, if you don't have, a class analysis, an analysis of capitalism, you can get co-opted by the environmental issues as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There also seems to be this sort of, kind of a hurry-up sense to it. We have to act now, or if we don't act now, we won't. And that could forestall any sort of long-term planning or long-term thinking.
Yeah, I think the acting now is to be serious about what the environment is and to be serious about what that means in terms of longer-term change, and then ask the question of, well, what do we immediately have to start doing now so we can build that capacity?
Mm-hmm.
And so you're always fighting to change things in the immediate period.
Right.
I mean, there's always struggles going on, but those struggles have to go on with some vision in mind about what are we trying to build at the same time? So that we don't get trapped into just fighting over a single issue and getting co-opted in it and not being very successful anyways, etc.
Absolutely, Sam. Unfortunately, we've run out of time.
Okay.
But I'd like to thank you.
Enjoy talking to you.
Okay. Thanks, Sam.
Okay. Bye.
That was Sam Gindin, former CAW member and current professor at York University. He put forward a lot of good ideas that, and everyone should think about, right? Right?
Yeah,
so,
definitely. I mean, I think that's some good advice in terms of movements here in Toronto, here in Canada, to kind of, step up a little in terms of, develop that kind of radical left-wing organizing that hasn't been happening. What other opportunity is there for organizing other than time of crisis, of increased oppression and lowering of wages, lowering of workers' rights?
Yeah, and just thinking differently and creatively, right,
Kabir? Yeah.
So I guess that's our show, unless you got anything else to say, some announcements. You should plug the demonstration tomorrow again.
Yep, so the buses again are leaving Dufferin and Bloor 4:30 p.m. And it's actually, I don't think it was mentioned, but it's a $10, I guess suggested $10 donation just to cover all the costs.
Right.
And so, yeah, so please contact, the email address is, and it's being organized by the QP3903 First Nations Solidarity Working Group. So the email address is 3903fnswg@gmail.com. 3903fnswg@gmail.com.
Right. Also, our new issue of Basics, it's available online. It's coming out, should be at everyone's doorsteps pretty soon.
I think you wrote an article for that.
Yeah, on Afghanistan. There's a lot of great articles in there on recent developments from Iran to, developments all around the world and locally. So
definitely check out the front page issue on, I think, last week we didn't have anybody in here,
no.
Unfortunately. But the week before that we did have on the grade 9 youth who was beaten
right.
by the police in Pelham.
Two weeks ago,
that's
yeah.
That's the front page article on Basics. Mm-hmm. Be sure to check that out, his full testimonial,
mm-hmm.
As well as an analytical piece, on police brutality in the city.
Yep.
But that's it for this week.
One more.
The
Jason. Basketball tournament.
Yes, the basketball tournament.
Yeah.
We don't need to plug that. Not important.
You're a horrible man. No, we have a huge basketball tournament, the Justice for Alwi tournament, coming up in August. We're going to be talking a lot more about this.
Yeah.
You'll probably hear ads about it, but if you got a basketball squad,
we'll have it etched in your brain by the time August 15th.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, just email Basics. It's on the Blogspot.
Yeah.
Basicsnewsletter.blogspot.com.
That's right.
Email us. We need teams, 3-on-3 basketball tournament, and 3 divisions, 16 and under, 18 and under, and above 18. Get at us.
True enough. So that's it for Radio Basics. Up next, blues music. Later, people.
Abriendo los caminos, unido en un canto canadienses y latino. Oh sí, mi familia aquí está pendiente, librando la batalla en todo el continente. Basta Babilonia de tanta mentira, resisto con mi canto como Irak y Palestina. Desde Alaska a la Patagonia, este background es para la historia. Maestro de ceremonia, guerreo mi victoria y la lucha y la peleo desde el principio al final.
Sí.
Aunque sufren esta vida el abuso policial, resistan pueblo, resistan la batalla. Se acerca la victoria, este canto de Macaya. Unido todos juntos en esta sola raya.
Justice and peace, welcome to Messiah.
From Caracas to Toronto, all the soldiers in the streets. The revolution may seem like a dream, cause of all of its past defeats. But as the
a lot of unions, a lot of working